This is the BBC.
Hello, you've downloaded a podcast of BBC Radio 4's The Food Programme. Welcome to our world, from cooking to culture, politics to pleasure. We hope you enjoy it.
Hello, and welcome to an edition that's actually made me rethink my New Year's resolutions. Out goes the pledge to buy fewer records, drink less coffee, and improve my Italian. Now on the list is a goal to try three very different foods in 2018. Let me give you a brief introduction. The first is a bloody, juicy, meaty burger that took nearly a decade and several million dollars to develop, because somehow all of the ingredients come from plants.
Here in San Francisco, there are several restaurants serving the Impossible Burger, and the red ones are juicier and have a meaty, bloody aspect of meat.
Next for my culinary ambitions for 2018 is a cheese that you can watch as it moves. That's because when you delve inside, it's alive with maggots.
It was very creamy. It had a very ammonia smell, and it's moving. If you look at it this way, it's actually a sign that it's fresh.
After that experience, I'd want something more familiar. And so I'll turn to one of my favourite dishes, a bowl of mussels. But the mussels I want to try in 2018 will have been grown in an unusual place, downtown Copenhagen, right in the heart of the city, urban shellfish.
This is completely full of baby mussels.
It's like a delicate necklace.
Yeah, it's beautiful actually. It might get a bit smelly if you wear it after a while, but they are beautiful.
What all three have in common is they represent ideas, projects and businesses that could shape the future of all of our food. I'll explain in a moment, but first, let's hear from my guest in the studio, Dr. Morgan Gay. Now, Morgan, you spend a lot of your time working with food manufacturers and retailers trying to predict the future. How and why?
As a food futurologist, I think about not just what we're going to be eating in the future, but why. Why that thing? Why that trend? Why will people suddenly latch onto that food, that way of eating that food at that particular time? And when I work for large companies, that's what they want to know. There is an element of a hunch, and then proving or disproving that hunch, and that's desk-based research, whatever's happening politically, economically, geopolitically in the world, which is influencing ingredient prices, for example. And at some point, with all of that data and with all of that information and the hunch, you have to put a flag in the ground and say, this and here's why.
And how does it work within the food industry? Perhaps with some input from you, how does a future food idea become reality?
Very different in all companies and also in the major food retailers. But they do have people who are looking to develop the next thing. Food business, of course, has different restrictions around it because it's about safety. We're ingesting that. The supply chain and the labelling laws are very stringent, especially in this country. So it takes a lot longer to get an idea from just a concept that's discussed around a table to an actual production facility, labelled, branded, tested, marketed and put on the shelves.
How long can it take?
So you're looking at about 3 years.
OK, Morgan, well, I'm going to share with you these three very different food projects that I believe will play a big role in the future. Let's start with burgers. Now, on a scale between 1 and 10, how much of a burger geek are you?
Oh, I'm at the bottom of the burger geek scale. I've never been a burger fan, even as a child. I think it's the texture. I didn't like the texture, the bitty, mealy kind of bits. So I'm not a burger fan at all. However, I'm definitely in the minority.
Well, let's see if I can entice you by taking you into a burger world created by a team of scientists in California, a startup company called Impossible Foods, which has created the so-called Impossible Burger.
You can see on the outside, we've got that nice golden crust, but in the center, it's still bloody and rare.
In the US, this has become one of the biggest food stories of recent months, attracting plenty of attention.
The future of food looks like this. It's the first step in an effort to take on the multi-billion-dollar meat industry. Hell, it even bleeds like a medium-rare burger. It's designed to convert meat eaters.
The Impossible Burger scientists aren't just making a vegetarian patty that you can eat instead of a burger. They want the Impossible Burger to be the same exact experience as eating a beef burger. And one molecule is essential to that flavor. It's called heme, and it looks and tastes like blood.
This heme molecule is found in very high levels in meat, but it's also found in plants. Its importance to the flavor of meat was only really discovered because the Impossible Food Team is made up of a wide range of scientists with backgrounds in neuroscience and biochemistry. And so when they looked at the challenge of creating a burger, they were in a position to ask some fundamental questions.
Challenge number one, why does meat taste like meat?
This is Pat Brown, a former professor at Stanford who founded Impossible Foods. He was a scientist on a mission.
The plant crops grown this year contain more than enough of every essential nutrient to meet all the nutritional needs of the world's population in 2050, 9 billion people. But people around the world love to eat meat. And who can blame them? It's delicious. So we've got a problem.
His idea was that if you could create a burger that appealed to meat lovers, including me, then it could open a gateway to a new generation of future foods. This is why Impossible has been described as the Tesla of the food world.
Animals are just an ancient, extremely inefficient, unsustainable technology that we use to transform plants into meat.
Impossible had the advantage of doing taste tests with one of the world's greatest food experts, Harold McGee, who since the 1970s has been the go-to person for understanding the science behind cooking. It turns out Harold was the person Pat Brown felt he could trust to help him as the burger experiments got underway. And I linked up with Harold in California on Skype.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Harold. How are you?
I'm very interested to hear about
I wanted to find out from Harold more about the food science behind the burger and what Impossible's research had revealed about meat itself.
I would say that something really fundamental about the nature of meat was discovered in the process of this investigation. There has been a discipline called meat science for many, many decades now. And through all those decades of studies from within the world of meat, no one had really understood what it is that makes meat taste like meat in the first place.
And Harold, this is the molecule called heme. And it creates a chemical reaction with other nutrients when cooked to create the flavor that we're familiar with, the flavor of meat. But Pat Brown knew heme could also be found in plants, particularly the root systems of the soya plant.
So the initial idea was, after Pat took a look around at where heme appears in the rest of nature, it turns out that one very concentrated source is the root nodules on leguminous plants, plants in the bean and pea family. And if you've ever gardened and pulled up a plant at the end of the season, you'll sometimes notice these reddish bumps on the roots of the plants. The pink color of those bumps comes from heme protein. So the first idea at Impossible was to go to soybean fields, harvest the root systems, and use this hitherto unused part of the plant to make meat flavors.
The other ingredients are potato protein, which makes the burger crispy, wheat gluten, which gives it a chewy texture, and the fat component comes from coconut, and obviously there's also the heme. So after all of this research and your tasting, Harold, what's the outcome? What does it taste like?
Well, it actually, as is true with regular beef, depends on the cook. Let me start just by saying that the experience of cooking it and watching it being cooked is very much like the experience of witnessing the cooking of beef. That is to say, it starts out bright red, and you start to cook it, and it begins to turn brown on the outside and a dark brown where it's getting nice and crisp. So the experience of cooking it is very much like the experience of cooking a real hamburger. And then when it comes to the actual eating, the textures and flavors, again, are very similar to what you would get in ordinary beef. In fact, a lot of chefs will say that they really like certain aspects of the Impossible Burger better than they like aspects of a real meat burger. You can get a really crisp crust on the surface of the Impossible Burger much more easily. And chefs and, I think, eaters as well like that.
Harold McGee. Now, Morgan, what really interests me about the story of the Impossible Burger and the work of Pat Brown is they've approached a food problem as outsiders to the food industry.
I think there's lots of other Silicon Valley startups, for example, who are collaborating with scientists, with fundraising, and coming together, perhaps with people who don't work in food at all, to create solutions, food solutions for our planet. And this use of legumes and beans, and I think we're already seeing other products, other food products, the most amazing solution to the egg. You may have seen that.
This is Hampton Creek. They've found the equivalent of heme for the egg. So it coagulates when you put it into a pan and behaves like an egg.
And I think for vegans, it's probably the hardest thing to replicate because it's the binding agent. It creates a lot of other foods where often meat just replaces meat. Fake meat is meat, you know, it doesn't have a lot of other uses. But with egg, it's really the thing that is most difficult to replace.
Impossible has received $75 million of investment, including from Google Ventures and Bill Gates. And it's been reported that Pat Brown has recently turned down a $300 million offer for his burger company. Now, if the saying follow the money is true, does this mean that this is a serious contender as a future food?
It's much easier for consumers to accept a new food when it looks just like something they already eat. And I think that's what makes it easy. And because it tastes so good, the studies have shown that a lot of consumers who are meat eaters can't tell the difference between a meat burger and an Impossible Burger. It's a pretty easy sell.
Well, our next future food story revolves around edible insects, a subject we've shied away from on the food programme, because we're yet to come across food products that haven't felt, well, just a bit gimmicky. But I'm changing my mind. And that's because of a husband and wife team. One is a chef, Roberto Fiori. The other is a researcher in sustainable food, Afton Halloran. And before we hear about their ideas, it's worth understanding how they met and fell in love in Sardinia over that maggot-infested cheese I mentioned earlier.
Our relationship started when I heard about a cheese called Casumarsu that basically is a product that comes from the island of Sardinia. At the time, I was working for the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations for the Edible Insects Program. I got Roberto's contact information while he was working in Sardinia. He comes from there, and he was a well-known chef there at the time. So basically, he was to be my contact to discovering this cheese, which one cannot buy. You actually have to know somebody with it because it's kind of illegal, actually. It's a cheese that has basically been infested by the larvae of a kind of fly called the cheese skipper. And basically, I got in contact with Roberto, and he showed me not only the cheese, but the culture behind the cheese.
And Roberto, for me personally, I think the cheese looks delicious, but can you describe and explain this cheese?
The cheese is a normal cheese. It's basically a natural fermentation starts inside of the cheese, and the gases produced during the fermentation crack the skin of the cheese. So these gases basically attract the fly, and the fly lays the eggs inside of the cheese. And the larvae start to eat the cheese, transforming from a hard piece into something really creamy and pungent.
So actually, the flies and the maggots are a fundamental part of the cheese-making process.
The larvae works as a kind of like natural fermenter, you know, like it's basically digesting the proteins and transforming into amino acids. So actually it's highly nutritional because it's a kind of like pre-digested food.
And do you eat the maggots? Do you eat the maggots as well as the cheese?
Oh, I mean, you eat all together.
When I go back to that day. It's the sights, the smells, the sounds. Entering into basically a room which was situated next to a barn in a farmyard and watching the farmer turn on this light, and then there's all these like balloon-shaped cheeses hanging from the ceiling, smelling that very animal smell that is emanating from the room, from the barnyard. You could see that this is a product that has a lot of history behind it. And what did I taste? It was very creamy. It had a very ammonia smell. It's quite strong cheese. It's moving. I mean, for some people, they would see this as something inedible simply for the reason that your food, in most cultures, having your food moving before you eating it might not be something you want to indulge in.
And visually alive.
And visually alive.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So we think that this kind of love story or the love bug or whatever you want to call it really is the basis for our passion for working on this topic.
From Sardinia and their meeting over a maggot cheese, Afton and Roberto started to travel around the world researching other ancient food cultures in which insects were prized. And the sound of crickets became a familiar one as they sampled delicacies across Africa and Asia.
Wherever you travel around the world, I mean, outside of, let's say, Europe, you see that insects are highly integrated into people's diets. In fact, most insects still consumed today, and there's over 2,000 of them, are actually seasonal. For example, in Central Africa, maybe at one point of the year, the major protein source for people is caterpillars, and then
termites,
and then that food source goes away until, you know, the next season.
And Roberto, as a chef, you started to discover new possibilities in the kitchen, new flavors and textures to work with.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating as well, because these 2,000 and more edible insects that are actually recognized around the world, basically they taste completely different. And so you can have a sour flavor, you can have flavors that can be really similar to the roasted pork skin, you can have sweetness, you can have pungency, you can have freshness like coriander. And as a chef, it's like opening a new book of flavors. It has been so fascinating for me.
Meanwhile, Afton, you were looking at projects to produce food on a large scale and techniques to farm insects in Thailand you've now seen being put into practice in Africa.
This is a very interesting pilot project that's going on in Kakuma in the northwestern part of Kenya, and basically looking at how those who are dwelling in refugee camps, and in particular this camp, is people are probably going to be destined to live there for the rest of their lives. And so for people to actually be involved in growing their own food, producing their own food, is really important in terms of food security and also in terms of good nutrition. And it's something that, if it works, if it's successful, it can be scaled up and it can be brought to other areas of the world where insects are a culturally acceptable food.
But for those of us in Europe, Afton, where, unless you're in Sardinia, insects aren't part of our food culture, there could be a different path. And in South Africa, you visited a business that's growing quickly, Agri Protein, where they're farming insects to produce feed for fish and poultry farms. Why is that interesting?
It's another way that we can basically see the application of insects into our diets. It's an innovation that definitely is a kind of ground zero, but we're going to see over the future, we're going to see this develop very, very quickly. A lot of people may never want to eat, perhaps in the Western world, would never want to eat an insect, but they might be okay that their chicken was fed on fly larvae. Same with fish. So we're actually moving closer to a natural diet for these kinds of animals, rather than giving them, you know, soy or fish meal, which is what we see right now, which of course has immense environmental impacts.
And I guess to conclude that for those of us who are suspicious or maybe unfamiliar, if we are fortunate enough to find ourselves in Sardinia, the least we can do is try some Kazumazu cheese.
Absolutely. It will be a true experience.
You just have to find it.
Afton Halloran and Roberto Fiori, and their work on edible insects has been documented in a new book called On Eating Insects. Now, Morgan, would you be tempted by a small spoonful of Kazumazu cheese, maggots included?
Ooh, I don't mind eating insects, but I think I prefer them when they're cooked. I think that's my preference.
Not a live, moving cheese.
No,
not
for
you.
Something for a TV show.
You've been interested in insects for a very long time, convinced they'll play a significant role for all of us in the future. Am I being too negative in saying I can't see that happening?
I think insects still have a role. I think that a bit like the Impossible Burger, it's another option, it's another solution for a textured protein. And of course, it's just about making the insects safe. It's about finding a way to develop some sustainable harvesting processes. And we're already seeing things like insects as a protein source being integrated into fruit and nut bars. We're seeing those sorts of things sold in health food shops. We're seeing cricket pasta. I mean, at the moment,
those are the foods that always struck me as being something of a novelty rather than a serious future food. You disagree?
I think for me, the novelty is an insect that looks like an insect with wings and legs, perhaps fried or coated in chocolate, and it's a sort of, that's the party novelty. But I think when it's integrated into food that we recognise, we don't really have the novelty anymore. It's just an insect protein. It's something crushed. It's invisible. It's a little bit like ground meat. You don't see it anymore as the object itself. I know of somebody who has been as part of a research project defatting insects and using the ground skeleton of the insect without the fat as a kind of, I suppose, a flour which smells quite chocolatey. So you could almost bake brownies from this pure insect flour. And then you have the fat itself, which has all kinds of properties like alpha-linoic acid, things that are great for the skin. But I think in terms of everything that is a new or novel food in Europe, there's so much more science and research and possibility still yet to be discovered, which is exciting.
OK, well, let's hear about a very different approach to food innovation. And this next story features one of my favourite foods, mussels. The idea here is to take the concept of urban farming and create a blue equivalent. That is food production in a city underwater. And I met up with the man behind this Copenhagen project.
My name is Joachim Bjerl, and I'm the founder of Maritime Allotments here in Copenhagen. We're standing in the Copenhagen harbour on a sunny Saturday morning, looking at the water.
I mean, I guess it's striking that from where we're standing, the expanse of water in the heart of the city.
The water here in Copenhagen in the harbour is coming from either the north or the south, depending on the wind and so forth. But in 2.5 hours, all the water in this harbour gets exchanged. So there's a lot of water flowing through, clean water.
Tell me about the idea you had back in 2011.
Our focus is food. You know, we want to produce something that people can actually eat and that people can engage in producing. In Copenhagen Harbour, there is a huge population of native blue mussels. The mussel is fantastic because it serves as a way of cleaning the water, and it creates the most sustainable source of meat protein that you can get. And on top of that, it doesn't cost anything. I mean, it just lies there. You don't have to feed it. You don't have to tend to it. It's there. You could feed your family on blue mussels and get them all the healthy protein and omega-3s and all the stuff that they need on mussels. The funny thing is that, you know, we have the largest coastline in the world compared to the number of inhabitants that we are in this country, but we don't eat the seafood that we pull out of the water, which is crazy. You know, we export it. So this is also a food cultural project that is somehow, you know, we're trying to make people aware that in these cold waters, we are actually able to produce some of the most fantastic seafood in the world. Let's eat it. Let's not export it.
And in a section of the harbour about half the size of a tennis court, a series of orange buoys show where the mussel population has exploded as Joachim and his team have placed ropes in the water.
These are heavy with the new mussels.
Wow. You're pulling up a metal cable beneath which are these long columns of mussels that have attached themselves to the rope.
And you can see these are pretty fair size, actually. And you can also see all the baby mussels that are attached to the large mussels.
Yeah.
These are all seedlings from this season.
and they're all over the place.
It's like a delicate necklace.
Yeah, it's beautiful, actually. It might get a bit smelly if you wear it after a while, but they are beautiful.
In terms of the mussels that you are harvesting from here, what happens to them?
Right now, we are using them to tell the story, and we're using them to tell the politicians also that they need to help us find a place where we can grow this for real. Because the problem is here that if we were to use this for human consumption, we would have to take out tests every time that we needed to take out something to eat, and that costs like 8,000 kroners to take a test. So you can
imagine. How many euro would that be?
That would be like 1,000 euro.
Every time.
Every time. So basically, you know, if we wanted to take out something, we would use all our money for that, and the mussels would have a price tag out of this world.
So what you're demonstrating in the center of Copenhagen, it's possible. It can work. You can produce mussels.
We can produce mussels. We just need to, you know, reprogram the way that we look at the world, and we'll see amazing new possibilities.
Joachim Hurl there in Copenhagen. Now, Morgan, urban mussels and bringing food closer to its place of consumption. What do you think?
I think that's fantastic. I think that's where we're going, and using urban space as part of the solution to the problem, whether that's rooftops. A lot of Manhattan and Brooklyn are starting to do that, using aquaponics, hydroponics to grow crops in the available spaces, in the tunnels around London. You know, there's things like growing underground, growing the herbs, things that like to perhaps can grow in artificial light, using dank, dark spaces to grow mushrooms.
Most of the people involved in these projects would acknowledge they are not going to feed cities. So what's their real value?
I think there's a couple of things that are interesting about these incentives, one of which is to teach people about food and have a relationship with the food they eat. This disconnect between food is where supermarkets will start to struggle in the future, where food starts to feel a little bit like it is a science project that's been vacuum-packed and presented back to us with a great marketing story. Consumers are waking up. They want to understand not just where their foods come from, but how it was made, how they can go and visit that, how they can really have a true relationship with food.
Well, Morgan, I need to put you on the spot now. Three very different future food stories. If you were to choose one to watch in 2018, which one would it be?
They're all amazing. I think they're all incredibly relevant, and all of these three ideas we're going to see playing out for years to come. However, this year, I think the Impossible Burger in the year of veganism 2018 is the one to watch, because I think this will become mainstream very quickly. So I think Impossible Burger is right on the money.
Dr. Morgan Gate, thank you very much. It's been so interesting covering these stories with you. Now, if you know of future food ideas starting to make an impact in the UK, we need to know about them now. They could be contenders for the future food category in this year's BBC Food and Farming Awards. Nominations close in a few days, so please just go online and search for BBC Food Awards.
Thanks for listening. You have until Monday, the 29th of January, to nominate. Please do. We're counting on you.
This is the BBC.